We have to be cautious of righteousness and anger and remember that we are one community.
A divisive issue in Anchorage heads to a public vote. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 24th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Mark Begich meets with President Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
I did a little education, I hope, on Alaska issues of what concerns we have may be around the Second Amendment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of the midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Anchorage Acting Mayor Matt Klayman wants to let voters weigh in on a controversial proposal to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination. A public hearing on the ordinance once again dominated the assembly meeting last night. Klayman thinks a city vote will help settle the issue. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Today, Mayor Klayman submitted a proposed charter amendment to the assembly clerk with the goal of putting the anti-discrimination question before Anchorage voters in the April 2010 municipal election. Unlike the versions already submitted to the assembly, this one involves the municipal charter rather than municipal ordinances.
The goal was to make it as simple and straightforward for the public as possible. And so rather than introducing a five-page ordinance that will result in loads of debate about what does this mean and what does that mean and what does the other thing mean, we introduced it as a charter amendment that adds just the words sexual orientation to two sections of the charter.
The current public hearing on the ordinance change has resulted in more than 400 people testifying, with over 200 still waiting their turn. The sheer numbers have impacted the assembly's ability to handle other matters, and the two sides remain divided with emotions running high. Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander predicts it will take at least another month to finish the public hearing. Mayor Klayman says putting the question on the ballot will give a more accurate assessment of the overall public view.
From watching the debate in the assembly, there is divisiveness within the community. What's unclear, and there's no real way of telling until it goes on the ballot, and I think it's going to go on the ballot no matter what, how divisive it really is and how deep that division really represents community values.
Because his proposal would change the municipal charter, it requires 8 of the 11 assembly members to vote in favor. Klayman hopes the public hearing debate on the charter change going to the voters would take less time than the current hearing process. Osiander isn't so certain.
I basically hate to have this community focus on just this issue for the next 6 months. I also have some concerns based on some of the peripheral behavior I've seen in the debate so far might escalate. However, I will listen and consider this. I don't have a firm response one way or the other yet.
The divisiveness marking the public hearing appeared this afternoon as the mayor was about to talk to the press. Pastor Glenn Clary of the Anchorage Baptist Temple appeared and wanted to participate. The Baptist Temple is a staunch foe of extending anti-discrimination protection according to sexual orientation. Because the church owns 3 radio stations and 1 television station, Clary said he should be admitted. The assistant to the mayor, Patty Ginsburg, refused on the grounds that neither the pastor nor any staff members of the church stations had ever taken part in any past press conferences. Ginsburg said Clary was not a member of the working press. Still smarting from the rejection, the Baptist Temple pastor reacted to the mayor's new proposal.
I don't think that he should put the city of Anchorage through this again. You see how divisive this has been already in our community, and now he's going to take it to another level, spread throughout the entire city on an electoral basis, and it's just not going to be good for our community, and he needs to back off and rethink what he's doing.
Assemblymember Sheila Selkrig recalled several people from both sides wanting to have the anti-discrimination ordinance go on the municipal ballot. But she also was concerned about the tone of new public hearings and subsequent assembly debate.
I'm committed to make decisions as I move forward that will support a peaceful and respectful discussion of what's before us and hopefully build an outcome that we can all respect. And we have to be cautious of righteousness and anger and remember that we are one community.
Clayman hopes the public hearing, debate, and assembly vote could take place in July. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Tempers are roiling over this week's decision by an Anchorage Policy Committee regarding the long-proposed Kinnick Arm Bridge project. Attorneys for the cities of Houston and Wasilla filed suit yesterday in response to a committee bid to delay the bridge plan. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Roger Purcell, mayor of the tiny city of Houston in the Susitna Valley, says it's just not right. He says he was unaware of the change in direction.
They're required to notify the city of Houston and the city of Wasilla of any major changes, 45 days by federal law and 30 days prior by state law. So we have an opportunity to respond to any changes to the long-range transportation plan.
Earlier this week, the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions Policy Committee, AMATS for short, acting on a unanimous vote of its technical committee, decided to delay the Kinnick Arm Bridge project for a decade. AMATS is composed of two state representatives and three Anchorage members, two from the city assembly and the city's mayor. In this case, Anchorage acting mayor Matt Clayman is sitting in on the committee until new mayor Dan Sullivan is sworn in on July 1st.
When Dan Sullivan was elected mayor, he and I discussed the bridge, and he was in favor of it. So, no, we were not prepared that a acting mayor for a short period of time would try to push his agenda through to remove this project.
Purcell says he was assured by former Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich that the Kinnick Arm Bridge was a priority, but a new administration brings changes. Purcell points to Anchorage Assemblywoman Sheila Selkrig, who sits on AMATS, as someone who wants to kill the bridge plan. Selkrig is on record as an opponent of the Kinnick Arm Bridge.
The public comment was open for months, and there was an opportunity for both of those cities to weigh in. There was nothing hidden about this. There were front page headlines in the Anchorage Daily News, which I know is delivered to both of their city offices. So I just think it's another maneuver.
Selkrig and fellow assemblyman and AMATS representative Patrick Flynn were served papers at last night's Anchorage Assembly meeting. Selkrig says the AMATS technical committee proposal is to remove the bridge plan from Anchorage's short-term transportation plan and delay it until after 2018.
It would seem strange for Houston and for Wasilla to think it's not appropriate for the assembly to determine what's in the Anchorage long-range transportation plan. So I will look forward to the judge's evaluation of it.
Houston and Wasilla's suit seeks a restraining order against the AMATS policy committee, which would stop it from acting on any decision for 10 days. Houston Mayor Roger Purcell wants the communities on either end of the proposed bridge to work together.
She doesn't care that it's a joint project, but the law does, both the federal law and state law. They're required to work with us on any project that is effective to all the communities, not just Anchorage.
Purcell points out that the Matanuska-Susitna area is the fastest growing in Alaska, and ground has just been broken for a new state prison there, which could benefit both Anchorage and the Valley if a transportation link across Kinnick Arm is built. Meanwhile, the AMATS Policy Committee is scheduled to take up the issue tomorrow. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A Washington-based company will take over management of the Mary Conrad Center, a long-term care facility in Anchorage. Prestige Care Incorporated will begin managing the nursing home July 1st. Prestige operates 45 other centers in Arizona, California, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. The Anchorage facility will be renamed Prestige Care and Rehabilitation Center of Anchorage. The state took over day-to-day operations of the 90-bed Mary Conrad Center in December when it revoked the license of Raindance Healthcare Group, Incorporated. A state inspection revealed conditions that investigators concluded were an immediate danger to the health, safety, or welfare of residents. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, taking a fresh look at the world's oceans.
The ocean is vast. It's out there. It's so big, how could we possibly hurt it? That's been the attitude for way too long.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich met with Supreme Court nominee Judge Sonia Sotomayor today in the U.S. Capitol building. The two sat down behind closed doors for a lengthy 45-minute session. Begich called it a good discussion.
I had an opportunity to talk to her about how her process is in making decisions and understanding more about her as a person. Also, I did a little education, I hope, on Alaska issues of what concerns we have may be around the Second Amendment issues around Alaska Native rights and the issues of Alaska Native community throughout our state, also environmental and development issues, just more of an education opportunity.
Begich says he was particularly interested in her interpretation of gun rights under the Second Amendment in the Constitution.
I was fairly satisfied of her recognition of the current Supreme Court ruling, and that is important to understand where she sees that, that ruling is the law of the land unless the Supreme Court does something different, which is important as I said, her philosophy of how she makes judgments is based on the law, not over-interpreting the law. And I think that was a very positive statement in the sense of the protection of individual rights of right to bear arms.
Meanwhile, some Republicans are criticizing Judge Sotomayor's record on the Second Amendment. Begich says he got some of the answers he was hoping for during their talk today, but he'll reserve his decision on whether to vote to confirm Sotomayor until the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearings, scheduled to take place next month. Begich says even though he won't sit in the confirmation hearings, he and the rest of the Senate will be paying close attention. Sotomayor's ability to serve on the court will come down to how the full Senate votes on her. Monday's Kensington Mine court decision could have impacts throughout southeast Alaska as well as other parts of the state. A training program hopes to place about 250 people in construction and other jobs at the mine. Some will come from the region's economically depressed villages. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Lillian Lundy is one of the people most directly affected by the Supreme Court's decision. The Juneau grandmother spent much of this decade working to reopen the Kensington Mine, about 45 miles north of downtown Juneau.
I started out as a camp maintenance person, and then I was a surface equipment operator.
Backhoes and dump trucks and that sort of thing?
Haul trucks, dozer, front-end loader, skid steer. Deckman, fuel truck. Yeah.
She was one of about 40 workers laid off last year when Kensington's owners decided to wait for a court ruling on its tailings disposal plan. Now that it's won, Core Alaska hopes to resume that work soon and begin production later next year. Lundy, originally from Ketchikan, says she enjoyed the remote mine site environment that included a diverse workforce from around southeast.
I worked with folks from Haines, from Mangoon, from Una, from Juneau, from Cake, from Anchorage. They were just from all over.
That's in part due to an employment consortium of three Southeast Native corporations, Juneau's Gold Belt, Klukwan Inc., and Cake Tribal Corporation. The group's Randy Wanamaker says, like Lundy, about a quarter of Kensington's employees have been Southeast Natives. That's included residents of villages with high unemployment rates. He says regional hire was also the case for another 25% of the mine's employees who work for one of the member corporations. Wanamaker says Kensington's resumed construction is expected to employ about 300 people, including the 40 or so still on staff. Once in production, the mine will carry about 200 workers. Wanamaker says another 170 or so will find jobs in support industries such as barging.
I think that would help stop the population decline of Southeast Alaska and begin to reverse it, because what we would have are career opportunities, long-term career opportunities.
Some of those hired will likely be former mine workers who lost their jobs over several years. Wanamaker's group is also working with the University of Alaska and the State Department of Labor to train prospective new employees. Village residents who win mine jobs send money home, but they don't necessarily get to go home very often. Bob Martin is vice president of Goldbelt, one of the native corporations contracting with Coeur.
It's kind of a double-edged sword there. They would have jobs, and they'd be able to support their families, but those jobs require they be here. We were looking at the possibility of having a dormitory-type arrangement people could stay in while they're working their shifts. Working 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, for instance, they'd be able to go home and spend that time off with their families. But, you know, we hadn't begun to run the numbers on what it would cost to build and operate.
Coeur and its backers blame the layoffs on environmental groups. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council and others went to court to block plans to dispose of waste rock in a nearby lake. But SEAC's Rod Cadmus says the job cuts were Coeur's choice.
SEAC worked with Coeur for a year and a half to come up with what's called the PACE tailings plan. And that's a plan that would move that mine forward, it would produce those jobs, and it would better protect the environment.
SEAC and other groups still have options that could block or slow the mine's opening, and economic issues with Coeur Alaska's parent company could also create delays. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
The Southeast Island School District is indicating that three of its schools will not operate in the coming year. As KRBD's Jay Marble reports, SISD is a rural education attendance area serving very small communities in sparsely populated areas.
Usually, SISD schools are in places with a limited tax base and without the means to operate their own schools. In the days of the floating logging camps, SISD was also mostly on floats, changing location as the work moved. In recent years, many of those floating schools were moved onto land, reflecting the changing nature of the economy and population. To receive a crucial piece of state funding, SISD schools must have 10 students enrolled during the October student count. Lauren Birch is the school superintendent. He says his district needs young families with school-aged kids. Right now, those families are not being attracted to the Southeast Island communities, and the older families are leaving.
You know, there's definitely a drain in Southeast Alaska. You know, we've had hard economic times in our small sites for some time, and I think we just kind of hit the wall a little bit. I mean, people try to hang on, and you know, we have disappearing people as well. We don't know exactly where they go always. It's not necessarily just the bigger towns in Southeast. They just seem to go.
Birch also says land sales, where undeveloped home sites are auctioned off by state agencies or the feds, are still attracting buyers, but from a demographic that does not have school-aged children who would attend an SISD school.
There was a time, you know, 20, 30 years ago, when you could have a land sale and new families would move and, you know, rough it and tough it out and get jobs in fishing or logging or something and be happy. Now when we have those land sales, it's just people on speculation or, you know, someone from somewhere else wanting a summer home. It just does not generate children. You can sell 20 lots and not generate a child.
State boarding schools, charter schools, and neighboring districts that bus students out of the SISD area all take a toll. SISD schools have sometimes operated with fewer than 10 students. Birch says last year there were three schools, Edna Bay, Port Protection, and Hollis, that did not meet the 10-student requirement. That was difficult because the district had to make do without the funding that comes with 10 students. This year, he says, there just isn't enough in the various budgets that can be moved to prop up the under 10 schools. He's hesitant to say a school won't operate because those statements might discourage a new family from moving in. However, it's not looking too good for Hyder. At this time, Birch knows of only 7 students committed to attending that site. He says there are no wintertime jobs to keep family in the area, though he is somewhat optimistic that the long-talked-about water bottling plant might eventually open. And things don't look good for the Whale Pass School either.
I don't believe there's any possible way. There's just not enough students there. even with the family moving in or something. So I don't believe El Paso will reopen. Well, we've said it will not. We've closed it. But, you know, we take a pretty, we'll look at that. I'll revisit that in middle of August.
Edna Bay is also scheduled for closure. Birch says any school that does not operate will be maintained and the heat will be left on in hopes that in future years there will be 10 students. In the meantime, SISD will offer families in those communities correspondence and other distance delivery services. I'm Jay Marble.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
A virus that has killed thousands of harbor seals in the Atlantic Ocean has been discovered in sea otters in Alaska and may pose a threat to other marine mammals living in the Pacific. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
The findings were published this month in the journal Emerging Infectious Diseases from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Lead author Tracy Goldstein is with the University of California Davis's Wildlife Health Center. She says the virus is called focine distemper and is part of a disease family that takes many different forms and affects a variety of species.
Distemper virus belongs to the Mobilivirus family, and there's viruses in there that are specific to lots of different species. So, for example, humans get affected by measles.
In marine mammals, scientists had already seen the disease cause two epidemics in populations of Atlantic harbor seals in the U.S., Canada, and Northern Europe. The first epidemic caused 23,000 seal deaths in 1988, while the second resulted in 30,000 deaths in 2002. Meanwhile, sea otters in southwest Alaska began dying off in high numbers earlier this decade, resulting in an Endangered Species Act listing. Scientists began taking samples from dead animals in the Aleutian Islands, Kodiak, and even Kachemak Bay, despite the fact that the population of sea otters in the bay is strong compared to those in southwest. Goldstein says what they found was that a bacterial infection was likely causing the animals to die.
One of the thoughts that was always in the back of our head with that was, is there something that's making these otters very susceptible to this bacterial infection? And one possibility is a virus. And so when we saw the antibodies in the otters out in Kodiak, and then we sort of put that together with what we were seeing in Kachemak Bay, we thought, well, we better just test a few animals from Kachemak Bay as well and see if it's there.
The virus did indeed turn up in samples taken from sea otters in Kachemak Bay and elsewhere in Alaska, but Goldstein says at this point, scientists aren't jumping to any conclusions.
Now is when the big work begins. We're now trying to figure out, is it associated with mortality? Is it not? What makes some otters succumb from it and what makes others not? Obviously, we have live, apparently healthy animals that appear to have the virus but didn't appear sick. And then we had these otters in Kachemak Bay that were dying from lots of different things and had the virus. So now we're trying to figure out what that all means.
In addition, she says they're also trying to pin down when and how the virus might have arrived in Alaska and been transmitted to a fairly localized population of sea otters. A lack of any testing or data paints a murky picture. Goldstein says one possibility is that virus-carrying seals traveled across the Arctic from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean, but at this point, there's no evidence supporting that.
We're beginning to collect samples from Arctic seals, ribbon seals, spotted seals, bearded seals, etc. And then we'll then move further south and do some testing of stellar sea lions. And so trying to understand, what species potentially have been exposed to this virus so then we can start to maybe understand how it might have moved down to sea otters.
Goldstein says the focine distemper virus poses no risk to humans who come in contact with infected sea mammals. The report is available online at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's website, cdc.gov. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
The 64-foot Ocean Watch sailboat is circumnavigating the Americas to teach communities on both continents about the vulnerable, changing oceans. The ship is in Unalaska this week to learn about the community and teach about their project. Captain Mark Schrader says the 13-month-long, 25,000-mile journey links learning to an adventure.
The idea started because a group of us were talking about what could be done to make more people aware of some ocean health issues that are critical to everyone's survival.
The multifaceted voyage involves scientists from around the country, educators, videographers, and more. On board the vessel are scientific instruments that gather constant streams of data about water temperatures, salinity, and pH, as well as weather conditions and the amount of sunlight. A camera takes 360-degree pictures from the mast 48,000 times per day. Ship oceanographer Michael Reynolds says they are amassing data from remote areas to supplement information used in more in-depth studies and to allow people to see new parts of the world.
So anything we see, if we see a pod of whales, if we see garbage, if we see anything, it's recording it.
Using the data, Reynolds says they can teach about unique aspects of the different ocean ecosystems, like the very low pH of the Gulf of Alaska.
And that's not necessarily from pollution or man-made causes. The cold, nutrient-rich water in the Gulf of Alaska just takes a lot of carbon, so you get a lot of carbon being absorbed into the sea surface from the atmosphere. We call that a sink. And there are sinks in the Southern Ocean, and there are sinks in the Northern Oceans. But the Gulf of Alaska is a very strong sink, and as you would expect, the pH drops. So that's a nice correlation.
The onboard scientists, who will change throughout the trip, will also collect samples from jellyfish to send back to labs for analysis. Jellyfish blooms tend to indicate changes in ocean conditions and hurt other fish populations. But the main goal of the project is education. Starting next month, the Ocean Watch crew will include an educator who will help develop and distribute a free curriculum for grades K through 8. Captain Schrader says they will use the voyage as a vehicle for teaching about important ocean characteristics and changes.
The ocean is vast. It's out there. It's so big, how could we possibly hurt it? That's been the attitude for way too long. What we're discovering now, in fact, is that we're upsetting fisheries because oxygen contents in the ocean, all kinds of things. It's a very fragile ecosystem, and if you change a little bit, if the pH changes in the ocean a little bit, it has huge ramifications that are just now being discovered.
The Ocean Watch began in Seattle earlier this month and will make more than 30 stops along the way. At each one, they will work with local organizations to teach about their research. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jay Marble in Craig, Casey Kelly in Homer, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.